The following live presentation by Rabbi David Aaron is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
What I want to discuss with you is the meaning of Shabbat. Why is Shabbat so central to the Jewish people? I mentioned to those who were with us last 3 weeks that when I was working for this Jewish organization, so I was really trying to think of exciting programs that would really motivate these kids to do something in a Jewish way. So I thought, what would be better than a Shabbat experience? And I walked up to the head of one of the chapters and I said, listen, I've got a great idea. I want to do a Shabbat experience. And she looked at me with like disgust. And she said, do you mean no tearing toilet paper? Right? And I realized, my gosh, you know, you say Shabbat, they think toilet paper. And so in jest, I said, yes, of course. That's the fact what Jews have been doing for thousands of years. We get together every Friday night. We put a roll of toilet paper in the middle of the table. Right? We sit in there and go, don't tear it. Don't tear it. Don't, you know. So what is Shabbat? Most people know what you don't do on Shabbat. Right? Most people know what you don't do on Shabbat. You don't tear toilet paper, you don't write, you don't shop, you don't use your car, you don't use your radio, you don't... I mean, everybody knows what you don't do, and yet when you add up what you don't do, rather than sounding like Me'ein Olam Haba, which is sounding like an experience which is similar to the world to come, basically sounds like hell. Right? I mean, what kind of day is that? Is that the way I want to celebrate, you know, a good holiday? I mean, this is my weekend. I've worked very hard all week long. I want to relax. I want to do what I feel like doing. And the sad thing is that what most people know about Torah, and specifically Shabbat, is what you don't do, which has never really been a turn on. I can't imagine someone really getting excited about a day where I don't do these things, right? But what, unfortunately, many people are not aware of, well, so what do I do on this day? Okay, what am I really celebrating on this day? What am I really accomplishing in this day if I can't accomplish the kind of things I generally think I like to do? In order to explore that, we're going to kind of like, I hate this terminology, kill two birds with one stone. So we're going to revive two birds with one class. And this is really going to be a class that belongs both in the Chumash class and the philosophy class, because we will be dealing with the story of Genesis. So we're going to kind of skip the first 6 days, go straight to the seventh day, chapter 2. And what we're about to read is in fact the Kiddush. What we're about to read is in fact what we say Friday night when we hold the wine and we sanctify the dead. All right? We all here? Okay. So, if you'll notice, just go to the verse just before chapter 2, where it says, V'yar Elohim et kol asher asah, God saw everything that he did, V'hine tov mod, and behold, it's very good. It's at this point where the Kiddush, the Friday night, what we recite Friday night to sanctify the Shabbat, we start here, V'hi erev v'ivokir yom hashishi. By the way, you might notice that people say the first four words, or five words, four words, quietly. They'll go, okay? And at that point, that it means, and it was evening, it was morning, the sixth day. And then we go into the seventh day. And heaven and earth and all its hosts, tzva'am, okay, all its hosts, became completed or finished. And God completed on the seventh day the work that he did. The work that he did. Vayishbot b'yom hashvi. And God refrained from action on the seventh day from all the malacha that he did. That's the verse we're working on today. Okay? From all the action that God did. Now, there's a couple of problems with this verse. What do you see here is strange? The general concept in Judaism is what? How long did it take for God, so to speak, to create the world? How long? 7 days? 6 days. 6 days God created the world, and on the seventh day God rested. Okay, that's the idea. That there's 6 days of activity, and the seventh day where God rests, which of course we need to understand what does it mean to be a tired God. So what do you think? What did God do? You see, according to this verse, it sounds like God did something on the seventh day. It says, and God finished his work on the seventh day. But I thought that God finished his work on the sixth day. So what in fact did God do on the seventh day? And that is a famous question, and there's many approaches to it. But what I want to share with you is Rashi's approach. And you've already heard about Rashi, Rav Shlomi Yitzchaki. What does Rashi say? He says a couple things, but I want to deal with one thing Rashi says. Rashi says that what was the world missing? Okay? The world was missing minucha, rest. That's what the world was missing. And so when the rest came, kalta v'nigmara hamalacha. The work, the melacha, was finished and completed. And he's very careful. When Rashi says something, every word is a gem. Okay? So if he says, kalta v'nigmara, meaning, well, you could, nigmara, these seems to be two similar words. Kalta, it could either be to become coal, whole, from the word coal. Kalta v'nigma, it became whole, and it became complete, it became finished. The malacha became finished and complete. Now what could have Rashi have said? Right? That when the menucha, when the tranquility, when the restfulness came, so then creation was finished, right? He could have used the word bri'ah. But he's using the word milacha, all right? And that's what we need to define. We need to define what is milacha. Most people are familiar what you can't do on Shabbat, but they're not familiar with what the root of the whole thing is, okay? So we have something called milacha, and that's what we are not allowed to do on Shabbat. Milacha, okay? Milacha. That's what we're not allowed to do. Rashi says that until Shabbat came, there was no rest. And until there was rest, the melacha, the activity, the work, was not complete. In other words, what was our question? Our question is, wait a second, I thought that God didn't do anything on Shabbat. But when I look at this verse, it seems that God did something on Shabbat. And God completed his work on the seventh day. But how could he complete the work on the seventh day when he should have completed his work on the sixth day? So Rashi gives us an answer from the Midrash. How does God finish his work on the seventh day? By resting. When God rests on the seventh day, this retroactively completes the work of the 6 days. Okay? The very fact that God abstains from this activity on the seventh day is what enables everything that happened during the 6 days to become whole and complete melacha. Until then, it was not a whole and complete melacha. So what we want to define is, what is a melacha? What am I not allowed to do on Shabbat, so to speak? What is it that God stopped doing which made it into a complete kind of melacha, complete kind of work? So you know, there's different words for work. There's the work milacha, but there's another word for work. What's that? Anyone know? Avoda. And that's a little different. In this context, there is, you know, sometimes words in Hebrew used in different contexts have different meaning. But in this context, we're going to pivot the idea of avoda, right, versus milacha. There is milacha and there is avoda, right? There is melacha and there is avodah. What's the difference? Before I got involved in Judaism, my sister got involved in Judaism. All right? And I thought she was cracked. I mean, I really thought she was nuts. She's keeping Shabbat. And you know, what a waste, and why is she destroying her life when you could do much more meaningful things with a good Saturday? And I was in high school at the time. My sister had decided that she was now going to be Shomer Shabbat. Now, during that time in high school, I was in this rock band. We were very proud because we were all Jewish, so we had that Jewish pride, which is, yes, it's an old Jewish rock and roll band. Of course, the best time to practice is on Saturday. I mean, that's the best time to practice. And my home was the largest from all the guys, so we used to practice at my home. And so Saturday morning, the friends would come over with the Fender amps and the guitars and the drums, and we'd have a good Saturday because that was what Saturday meant to me. However, early in the morning, my sister would rise and go off to synagogue for her meditation and prayer to enjoy the tranquility of Shabbat. While she's in synagogue, my friends come over, and we're hanging out, practicing the most important things of our life, which was songs like Sympathy for the Devil, and, you know, other very inspiring kinds of songs from the Rolling Stones and all the other heroes of my life at that time. And, what happens is, I kind of hear down the walkway my sister on her way, coming home from shul, so I say to my friends, "Shh, guys, it's Shabbos. You know, it's Shabbos. My sister's coming home," and I hear the key go into the door, and just as she's about to open up the door, we give her this electrifying, "Shabbos!" You know? And so my sister would go, "Oh, my brother, he's such a disgusting, I can't wait," you know? And I just thought she was crazy, and I was being a rotten brother, but I think that's the merit a brother has. But whatever. I mean, what would be a brother if you can't be that kind of a brother? But anyways. And I would drive her nuts. I would just drive her nuts. I mean, she'd get phone calls from friends, and I'd say, "Hetty, the phone for you." She'd say, "You know it's Shabbat. You know I can't. Would you like me to say that?" "No, I can't ask you to say it." "Well, then what should I do with the phone now?" I would just kind of drive her crazy. Then I'd ask her questions like, "Well, isn't it true you're not allowed to, like, turn on electricity?" And she said, "Yes, that's right, that's right." I said, "Uh-huh. So, are you allowed to walk on Shabbat?" She said, "Of course, Shabbat, it's walking. You know, it's important to walk." So I said, "Uh-huh. I said, "Well, so wait a second. I mean, from what I understand, when you're walking, are you not creating electrical friction by your foot on the ground? And isn't that electricity?" And like my sister would go, "Oh, can't." I would just come up with these really retarded questions, which I thought were really brilliant at the time. And you kind of really wonder, so what is Shabbat? What are you not allowed to do? Because it sounds really crazy, right? What you're not allowed to do is milacha. But that doesn't mean you can't do avodah. Let me give you an example. It has nothing to do with physical exertion, which is really important to understand. Generally, people understand Shabbat to be a day of rest. Okay? But if you notice, sometimes on Shabbat you can get really tired because you're serving, and that sometimes can be tiresome, and you're cleaning up, and that's tiresome, and as well as you might have to move chairs, or you might have to move tables. Is it permissible to move a table on Shabbat? Basically, yes. Okay? Basically, yes. Certainly inside a house, you can. Well, that's certainly more physically exhausting than to go flip on a switch. So therefore, clearly, milacha is not a function of physical exertion. Okay? It has very little to do, if anything, to do with physical exertion. But rather, milacha has to do with creativity. It's called malachat machshevet. It's called an action of mind. Machshevet. Okay? Therefore, it has to be an action which is born out of intention and mind. It is a creative act. It's not simply some mindless physical act, but quite the opposite. It's a very mindful, skillful, intentional kind of act. All right? Let me give you an example, a halachic kind of example. According to the Torah, you are not allowed to plow on Shabbat. Alright? Now we have a question. Let's say I have a table, right? This shtender right here. It's Shabbat. And I'm outside. And let's say there's an arrow, if I don't want to confuse it, but okay. And let's say I'm schlepping this shtender down the street. Alright? Now as I'm doing that, essentially what I'm doing, because it's ground, what I'm essentially doing is plowing. But of course my intention isn't to plow, my intention is to, right, move this table. There's nothing wrong with moving this table. There's something wrong with plowing. Okay? So now, if my intention was to plow, then that would be, in fact, something forbidden to do on Shabbat. If my intention was not in order to plow, so then it's not so clear that that would be forbidden on Shabbat. There's other parts to the equation, so I don't want to confuse you. But just to give you an example how your intention, right, the intention to complete a particular kind of creative act is what qualifies it in terms, or defines it as a malacha in contrast to an avodah. An activity which is creative versus a laborious kind of activity, which doesn't need intention nor mind, it's simply a laborious kind of thing. Alright? Now, let's go back to what Rashi said. Rashi said that when God, what was the world missing? What the world was missing was minucha. What the world was missing was rest. When Shabbos came and there was rest, then malacha became finished and complete. In other words, without rest, then it wouldn't be a complete melacha. Why? What does it really mean to do melacha? Melacha is a creative act, whereas avodah is a laborious act. A melacha takes intention and mind, where avodah doesn't necessarily need any intention and mind, you just do it because you're doing it. What determines whether an act is a melacha or an avodah? What determines if an act is a creative act or a laborious physical stress? The ability to stop and the ability to start. Okay? Listen carefully. The ability to stop and start. If I can't start this activity and if I can't stop this activity, then basically I'm a mindless, compulsive, laborious slave that cannot stop. I'm simply a robot. I'm simply an automaton, all right? And that's the difference. Creativity is mind, creativity is intention, creativity is something I start to do, and creativity is something I stop doing. Now, if I start a creative act but I can't stop, then it no longer is really creativity. What it really becomes is a mindless, laborious, you know, compulsive activity. I become a victim to some kind of force that's carrying me through rather than a master of the situation as I design the situation. Is this okay? Are you following the idea? Okay. Why is this so important? Because when we celebrate Shabbat, what are we really saying? We're saying that God stopped creating the world, which retroactively indicates to us that God also started creating the world. In other words, what's the choices vis-a-vis the world? Either the world always existed, or the world is an expression of laborious, mindless, natural laws, okay, that are just churning out this world, or the third possibility is, in fact, the world is an act of creation, an expression of will and intention. Okay? That's the difference. What world do you live in? Do you believe you live in a world which is merely the product of blind, laborious, natural forces, which are simply being, you know, pumping out the world? Or do you believe that the world is a function of a mindful, willful, intending reality? That's the question. Of course, what's the difference vis-a-vis myself? If I live in a world that is the product of intention, if I live in a world that was meant to be, I live in a meaningful world. All right? A world that wasn't meant to be is not a meaningful world. A world that simply is the product of some kind of laborious, blind forces, natural forces that just kind of knocked it out. So fine, that's the world. Right? It's some kind of evolutionary process, fine, but it doesn't have a theme. Because it doesn't have a beginning, it doesn't have an end, it doesn't have direction, it doesn't have intention, it doesn't have mind. That's really the choice. How do I perceive my world? Okay? How do I perceive my world? What happens when God, so to speak, when we celebrate and we testify that v'yechul ha'shamay v'arz v'kol tzavam v'yechaloi v'yom ha'shvi melechto v'sher asah? What happens when we on Friday night get together and testify that the world was finished? We are testifying that the world is a creation. That's what we're testifying to. The world is a creation, which means it's meaningful, it's purposeful, it has a theme, okay? It has direction. And that's the essence of Judaism. That's the foundation of Judaism, that's the world. It means that we believe that the creator of the world is not simply natural laws, and that this world is simply some mechanistic expression, but rather this world is an expression of creativity. And creativity must have beginning and end, and it cannot be compulsive. Otherwise it becomes, once again, nature at work. When the Jewish people remember creation, that's what they're remembering. Changes my whole life. Changes my whole week. I've got to remember this. Now what happens when I stop on Shabbat and I identify, it's very nice, okay, so God keeps Shabbat, fine. I testify that in fact, creation had a beginning and creation had an end. Or at least segments, okay? Stops, rests. Then I say, this could not be the act of some kind of natural force, because natural forces don't stop. They just go on. They don't start, they don't stop, they just are. But that's not what kind of world I believe in. So it's very nice that God stops, it's very nice, I'm very happy, and I've just testified the world is meaningful. Why then do I need to stop doing milacha, creative activity? Okay? Because when I stop, I renew the image of God that I've been created in. Because am I merely an animal that functions based on natural laws that propel me along from an instinctual level? Or am I a free-willing, mindful, intending being? Right? And that's really the question, because some people can't stop. They don't know how to take a rest. They don't know how to stop what they're doing. In other words, what they've really become is some kind of robot. What they've really become is some kind of automaton. They can't stop. They're compulsive. These are not people who do milacha. These are people who do avodah. They are avadim. They are slaves to their job. They are slaves to their instinct. They are slaves to the situation. Rather than doing milacha, which in fact has the name angel in it. And malach is an angel. And the choice is either to become a malach, an angel, or to become an eved, which is a slave. That's really the difference. That's really the difference. And so I once shared with the group last time that there's a very cute film. In fact, Gesher put out this film, which I'd like to show you, which is a cartoon about Shabbat. And basically the way it goes is, you've got this very busy day in Manhattan, a lot of noise and a lot of traffic, and first of all, you see this policeman in the middle of all this traffic, but he doesn't have a head. He has a whistle for a head. Okay? And then you see all these people walking down the street, but nobody really has a head. This guy has a computer monitor for a head, this guy has a pen for a head, this guy has a wrench for a head, and nobody has a head. What they really become is their career. They are their career. They're not the masters of their career, that's what they are. And there's a lot of tension going on in the cartoon. It's getting, and very so often, it flashes to a clock that's ticking and ticking, and it's coming closer and closer, and there's this guy who's got an attaché case for a head, right? And he's walking home, and everybody looks like robots, right? Walking around, doing things, and brilliant. And then he walks into his house, and that very second, he sits down in a soft chair, the bell rings, and all of a sudden his face melts, his attaché case melts into a warm face, and he says, "Ah, Shabbos." Very beautiful, very sweet cartoon. But that's really it. I mean, it really delivers the point, which is I've lost my humanness. I've become a career. I am my career rather than I have a career. Right? I lead a career, but if I am my career, then my career leads me, and I'm just simply the victim of some kind of natural, mechanistic world, that I'm just another cog in this big machine called planet Earth. Shabbos is anti-mechanism, right? Shabbos is anti that notion that the world is simply a big machine that is going according to natural forces that never was set into motion, but was always in motion, and I'm simply a cog in this whole big machinery. And when I stop on Shabbat, I demonstrate that I'm not a compulsive, laborious, blind, mindless force, but rather I'm a human being created in the image of God. And I make my own choices. Now for me, one story that sticks out in my mind that really demonstrates this is a friend of mine who is a very, very successful businessman. And he's cut some of the most outrageous deals. And if I tell you, you probably even know who he is because he was in the newspaper a couple of times for some of the things that he has done. He's a religious Jew, and he's a very, very clever, you know, honest and clever businessman. So he was working on a deal to purchase IBM Canada, right? Which is not small, you know, little thing called IBM. And but I don't know what was going on, but there was some kind of negotiations and there was some kind of progress going on, but it had to be in litigation in court. So this whole deal was happening in court, and there was a lot of factors going on. Well, it'd been going on for a couple days. It gets to Friday, and you know, and then can't believe it. It's going hours and hours, this, that, this contract, this issue, that issue. And now it's starting to get close to Shabbat, right? So he's got about another hour to go before Shabbat. He turns to everybody in the court. He turns to the judge. He turns to the people involved in this deal. He says, I'm sorry, we have to somehow close this because it's almost Shabbat, and I got to get home. Right, and this, and the court was down by the lakeshore of Toronto, and to get up to his home was a real good piece, about maybe 45 minutes. So he said, we gotta close this. He said, sit down, we're almost there, we got a big deal here, and it's gonna be fine. Okay, so he's waiting, and it's getting closer, and he says, listen, you gotta understand, it's almost Shabbat. You know, if we can't close this now, then forget it, we'll start up on Monday. So you know what these deals are like. When you get to such a momentum, you don't stop these deals. You know, to try and get back to, you know, remember where we were at and to deal with the whole thing, to get back to where we were mentally, psychologically, in these kind of deals, and we'll start on Monday, you just don't do that, right? So they thought he's nuts. I mean, we're talking about a multi-million dollar deal. Are you crazy? Right? You're like, calm down. Anyways, he's getting closer and closer. He realizes that's it. There's no way. He said, I'm sorry, but that's it. We either meet on Monday, and I said, you're gonna destroy this deal. He says, okay, I've got a much more important deal with my maker, right? And he said, I'm sorry. And they were in shock. He literally walks out on a deal and tells them, if I'm going to lose millions of bucks, I wouldn't give it up for my Shabbos, right? So now he gets into his car. He's got a Jaguar, okay? And he starts zooming up the street in his Jaguar with a fellow who works with him. And it's so late that he can't afford not to go through red lights. So what he actually does is when he gets to a street, he has his friend run out, stop the traffic, he goes through, and he starts zooming up, which is called Bathurst Street, which is like a long street up Toronto. He's zooming up the street, he's looking at his watch, and he's got another 15 minutes to get home, but he's only got another 5 minutes to Shabbat, and what is he going to do? So you know what he did? He pulled into a stranger's driveway, right, knocked on the door, okay, this fellow would not carry his watch, or his wallet, or other things that he couldn't carry. He had all his money and all his everything he had, and all the papers for this deal. He knocks on the door of a stranger. He has no idea whose door he's knocking on, right? The guy opens up the door. The first thing he sees is a nice Jewish boy hanging there. And the first thing he sees is this Jewish boy, and he says to him, excuse me, sir, but I am a religious Jew. And in the next 4 minutes is Shabbat. Would you mind taking care of my Jaguar? And hands the guy the keys to his Jaguar. Right? The guy was in absolute shock. He said, yeah, sure, buddy. Yeah, sure, buddy. And the guy walked home the rest of the way. What makes people do these kinds of things? What enables a person to overpower the forces of nature, the forces of a business deal as we're moving and we're propelled and we're going to make it and we're going to succeed, and just say, sorry, I am not a slave to this deal. And if I lose it, I lose it. I don't care. There's something much more important to me. And so when we stop for Shabbat, what we're saying is we are not a natural force. We are not these compulsive automatons that are not in control of our lives. But rather, we identify with the one whom we are created in his image, and that is what we believe in, and we want to identify with that divine process. So Shabbat is Zechu Lamasa Bereshit. Shabbat is a memorial. It's to remind us of Maseh Bereshit, which literally means the action of beginnings. Maseh Bereshit is often translated as the action of creation, but it's not really true. Because the word Bereshit means beginning. And so therefore Shabbat is to remember beginnings, remember ends, and remember that I'm in control of things. Alright? And if I can't stop, if I can't let go of my car for one day, I don't have a car. A car has me. If I can't let go of my job, I don't have a job. A job has me. And that's what I have to decide, whether I want to become a master of my life or whether I become a victim of my life, a victim of a kind of mechanistic world that I'm just, you know, in the wash of it. Now, we also know that Shabbat is to remember Yetziat Mitzrayim, the going out of Egypt. Okay? And the two are totally related. Okay? Because going out of Egypt is about freedom. And celebrating Shabbat is celebrating being created in the image of God, which is in the image of perfect freedom. The world is not a function of natural laws which are not free but are compulsive, but rather the world is a function of a free willing reality. And I'm created in the image of that reality. And as a mirror of that reality, I too am a free willing being. I am not a slave. But more than that, what does really Egypt represent for the Jewish people? Getting out of Egypt wasn't simply getting out of a situation that was uncomfortable. I mean, even though it was very uncomfortable. But there's more to it. Getting out of Egypt is getting out of Egyptian consciousness. All right? Getting out of an idolatrous community. Now, what really is the essence of idolatry? Right? Which, you know, idolatry is the antithesis of Judaism. If there's anything Judaism has come to destroy in the world, it's idolatry. But many think that, you know, Judaism has done its job. There's not too many people bowing down to rocks. Maybe rock stars, but not rocks and trees. Okay, the job is done. We don't need Judaism. The question is, really, what essentially does idolatry mean? It's not simply a form of bowing down to this or that. It's really based on a much more central understanding of reality. Right? Paganism and idolatry is the deification of nature. Alright? Nature is God. God is nature. This, by the way, many years later was reinstated by Spinoza. That's why Judaism and the Jews had such serious problems with Spinoza. Because really, I'm saying God is nature, nature is God. But then if God is nature, nature is God, then God is not a free-willing being. Okay? God is a force. God is a law. God is a principle. But not a warm, relating reality that has concern and care and willfully directs the world. You follow this? In Egypt, they deified nature. Right? And that's really what it's all about. And idolatry has to do very much with determinism, complete determinism. Because there's no freedom in the world. It's just a big machine that just works according to principles of nature. And nature is God. Now you might remember in the movie, maybe even in the book, that Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, has a dream. Right? Do you remember what his dream was? He had a dream about 7 lean cows and 7 fat cows. Do you remember this? And then he had another dream where he dreamt about 7 lean, I don't know if we call it lean, but poor stock of wheat, and then, you know, more fatter, you know, richer stock of wheat. And he wakes up and he's like blown away. He's really nervous about what does this dream mean? What does this dream mean? So he starts to ask his dream interpreters. Now, according to our tradition in Egypt, there were a tremendous amount of dream interpreters in those days. Nowadays, you know, it's not as popular, unfortunately, to a certain extent. But in those days, dream interpretation was very big. And what happens is that nobody can interpret his dream to a satisfaction. In other words, he tells over his dream, and they say, oh, this is about your daughters. You're going to have 7 daughters. And they come up with this bizarre interpretation of what the meat and what the wheat means and what the cows mean. He doesn't like it. And so all these dream interpreters come in there and nobody can give him an interpretation that strikes his intuition that that's the message that this dream has for me. Alright? Now listen to this. One of the people working for him says, oh, I remember this Jew boy. this young Jew boy in prison that I had a dream and my friend had a dream, and he came and interpreted it, and his interpretation was absolutely correct. Oh, I just remember this Jewish guy, young kid, right? King says, bring him over here. Right? Within seconds, all of a sudden, and that, by the way, is a whole other lesson, here's this kid who is really at the bottom of the bottom, feeling like, ah, I'm lost. Within moments, everything turns around. Now he's standing, dressed beautifully in front of the king, and the king tells him over his dream. All right? Tells him over the dream, and Yosef, the dream interpreter, right, gives him an interpretation. He says, King, this dream is about economics. This dream is about agriculture. This dream is telling you that there will be 7 years, good years, and then there will be 7 bad years. And by the way, this is what I suggest you do. And Joseph comes up with this brilliant economic plan to save Egypt from bankruptcy. Now, this whole story is so bizarre, right? I mean, wait a second. You have all the finest dream interpreters, the finest dream interpreters, and they're giving Pharaoh all these interpretations, and all of a sudden this Jewish boy comes up and gives an interpretation which is, isn't it a little obvious? I mean, if you have a dream about cow and wheat, and you're an agricultural society, wouldn't that be obvious? Lean cows and fat cows, I mean, what? Why would anybody say, this is about your daughters, this is about, and come up with those most bizarre, ridiculous interpretations, and it took this Jewish boy to come up with the interpretation. Do you follow the question? Right? What do you think? What is it that Joseph has that enables him to have such an interpretation? This is the answer I heard from the Rosh Hashiva of Teret Kohanim, which I believe is a brilliant answer. Only a Jewish boy could think this way, because only that Jewish boy wasn't an idolater. You see, idolaters deify nature. Who was the central god of Egypt, or one of the central gods of Egypt? The Nile. The Nile was a god. And what was the source of their agricultural wealth? The Nile had a very consistent natural pattern of overflowing its banks and irrigating the area and going down and going up and going down. It was nature. It was consistent. It was mechanistic. And it was God, right? And nobody in a million years amongst the Egyptians could ever offer an interpretation like Yosef offered. Because it's the very antithesis of idolatry. How can you say nature is going to stop? Something, a fluke, something ridiculous is going to happen for hundreds of years. This is the pattern, the natural pattern of the Nile, and all of a sudden it won't do that? Right? But who does have the ability to say this interpretation? Yosef, who says, this is what Ha Elohim is coming to tell you. This is what the God is coming to tell you. That nature is not God, right? And nature isn't necessarily consistent and is not reliable because there's a super nature. There is a divine reality who can choose to stop nature from doing that. And that was remarkable. Right? Do you hear this? It's a remarkable interpretation. It was the most obvious interpretation to you and me, but it wasn't to them because in order to say that, they would ultimately be demonstrating a disbelief in the deification of nature. The deification of nature is the deification of determinism, the deification of I'm an animal, you're an animal, and we can just do what comes to us. In fact, that's what we have to do. And we mentioned last week that the ultimate moral implications of idolatry is Nazism. Right? Hitler is exactly the fruit of paganism. Because Hitler said in Mein Kampf, we are barbarians and we are proud of it. And I am liberating man from the conscience of the world, the Jews, who have afflicted 2 wounds on us. He said they afflicted circumcision on our bodies and has afflicted conscience on our souls. That's what the Jews did. The Jews said to man, you can surpass yourself. The Jews said to man, you are not an animal. The Jews said that nature doesn't rule, but you can transcend nature and you must transcend nature because you have will, because you create the image of God and you mirror the ultimate reality which is beyond nature, which is the source of nature, and yet can transcend nature. And that is what's so important to understand. The Judaism's fight against idolatry was Judaism's fight against Nazism all the way back then. And if the world would have fought it with the Jews, we wouldn't have the kind of people like Hitler. But that's really the essence of Nazism. The essence of Nazism is the deification of nature. If my nature wants to kill you, I kill you. If I try to stop my nature, I will be miserable. I am being foolish. There's no reason to try and surpass my nature, because nature is the be-all and the end-all of reality, and you cannot transcend your nature or this nature. And therefore, idolatry doesn't believe in miracles, because miracles means I can transcend nature, right? Nature can be transcended, even though, from a scientific point of view, this is what's going to happen. Who says? And I had a student, a woman who was in her 60s, and she was coming to my class. I was giving classes in the center of town. She came up to me, she said, you know, Rabbi, my whole life I never believed in God. Never believed in God. And one day, and this happened last year, something happened to me and there's no way, there's a God. So what happened? She said, I was working as a doctor in, I think it was somewhere in Africa. She was working with people and, you know, really devoted woman to saving people and everything. And she says, and there was a person that I diagnosed, and it was absolutely clear they had no chance of living, not a chance of living. And one day, I took a blood sample, I was looking at it under the microscope, and literally before my eyes, I saw the disease just disappear. She said, and that was it. It was a miracle. I mean, this was scientifically impossible. There are plenty of scientifically impossible situations that have happened in the world. And so is science the be-all and the end-all? Do we worship nature? Is nature God? And if so, then I must serve nature and be subservient to nature and whatever comes to my nature, whatever I feel like doing, the survival of the fittest is what's right. Right, might makes right. That's the law of the jungle. Are we in a jungle? And is the law of the jungle what rules? Or are we in a world that's created by a God, created in the image of God? And we've got free choice. That's what it means to celebrate Shabbat. Every Shabbos, that's what you say to the world. That's what you say to yourself. That's what you say to God. And that becomes the soul of the week. Because it's a whole different week. After Shabbos, I don't go back into the jungle. After Shabbos, I go out there with a sense of mission to build this world into a kingdom for the divine, for the image of total freedom. And that's what's so frightening about the world when they forget what it really means to celebrate Shabbat. What I'm doing on Shabbat is I'm not just simply not tearing toilet paper, not turning on lights. I'm celebrating freedom. I'm celebrating creation. I'm celebrating the fact that God is not nature and nature is not God, but that there really is a God who is transcendent of nature, the source of nature, and can transcend nature and can bring miracles. Shabbat restores to me hope. Hope? If there isn't a Shabbat, then what hope do I have? If I look at history, if I look at nature, then there's certain rules, and those rules are going to happen. But when I look, and I realize miracles, miracles. The pasuk continues. The pasuk says, V'yichul ha'shamayim v'aretz v'kol tzvaam. God finished heaven and earth. He finished it on the seventh day. How did God finish His milacha? By resting. If God would not rest, then we would not know this is Malacha. We would not be able to celebrate the beginning and the end. We would not be able to celebrate Sof Maaseh B'Machshavat Tchila. The end was already in the beginning of the mind. That this world is designed with intent, with will, with consciousness, with vision. It's got a theme and I'm part of it. It was meant to be, and therefore I was meant to be, and therefore this is a meaningful world. And I treat you and I treat me and I treat my family, I treat everybody like meaningful beings. Not simply automatons, natural beings that are floating around in natural space. But then it continues on and says like this, Vayishbot b'yom ha'shvi mikol melachto, which is wild. Wait, you just said God finished all that He did on the seventh day. And then it says Vayishbot, and then He refrained from everything He did on the seventh day. Listen to this midrash. The oral tradition says that what did God do? The oral tradition said that God didn't even finish the world. Okay? That's what the Midrash says. God didn't finish the world. Now you say yourself, what? God didn't finish? No, God didn't finish. It was getting late. It was Friday. He still had a couple more things to complete. It was getting late, and God just stopped on Shabbat. That's what it means, Vayishbo. He actually abstained in the middle of work. Okay? That's what the Midrash says. The guy didn't really even finish the job, but rather stopped in the middle. And that's what made the job even more finished. Listen, that's what made the job even more finished. Why? Because once again, if you can't stop on a dime at any moment in your process, once again you're a victim. Right? Once again you are being carried in a compulsive way. And so this Midrash is saying that God stopped even before he finished. He doesn't even have to finish the world. Because God doesn't have to do anything. Because God is a free reality. A completely free reality. And this is what this Midrash is telling us. That God didn't even finish the work. And that's what made it even more finished. In other words, if I'm painting a picture and I can't stop in the middle, I gotta finish this. Well then who's painting the picture over here? Who's leading who? Who's the master of who? Right? In addition, what this demonstrates is, this Midrash tells us that this is an act of love. Because an act of love is an act that you do when you want to do it, and you stop doing when you want to, but you're not compulsive about it. God didn't have to finish the world. If he had to finish the world, then the world would not be an act of love. Right? It would be an act of what we call din. It has to be. But it didn't have to be. God doesn't have to create the world. Our understanding is God wants to create the world. And what does that mean to me and my world? Once again, it means that this world is not simply a means to God's end. Did God have to create me? That he had a mean, and I'm the means to God's end, and he's got an end that he's trying to accomplish through me? Right? Well, then he doesn't love me. I'm just simply being used over here. Okay? And I'm not really an act of love. So Shabbos also is celebrating that this world is an act of love. That God didn't have to create it, and he didn't have to finish it. And that testifies to me that it was an act of love. In addition to that, why is it so important that I stop working on Shabbat? It also has to do with how I perceive myself. Let's look at the bottom of this piece. Verse 3. It says, and God blessed the seventh day. And he made it sacred. Because on this day, God rested from all the creative activity that he created to do. What did this verse really say God created to do? What does it mean that he stopped the work or the activity that he created, that he created to do? What did that verse just tell me God was really creating? Did God simply create a world? This verse says he created work to do. Wild, right? That's what the verse says. What did God really create? He created a world that's full of work to do. Right? He in fact created a very incomplete world. He created a world that's full of a lot of work to be done. And the Midrash says, work to do, who's going to do that work? God stopped the work that he was creating the work to do. What work to do? That's what he created. He created work to be done. Right? And who's going to do that work, the Midrash says? You and me? That's a perfect world. The perfect world for a human being is a world that enables the human being to participate in creating it. What a world. There's something for me to do here. Because if there was nothing for me to do here, what a boring world this would be. What a sad world this would be. There's nothing for me to do here. A human being naturally needs to contribute to their environment. That's natural. When people are not like that, they're sick human beings, right? They've lost touch with what it means to be created in the image of God. Because as God is a creator, I need to be a creator. So God created a perfect world for cultivating creators. There's a tremendous amount of creative opportunity in this world to be done. And this is God's gift to us. That there's something for me to do here. And you know, children know this. Children know this. Children, at an early stage, until they kind of lose touch with this naturalness, they want to help in the house. They want to do something in the house. I mean, I can't tell you the joy, and also the fear, of watching my son, who's like 2 years old, take the broom and start trying to clean up the kitchen. Of course, as he's swinging around the room and knocking down the sugar and knocking over the, you know, and okay, we got to be so careful. Because the natural tendency of the child is to want to do something in this house. They don't want to simply be takers. They want to be givers too. They want to contribute. They want to be creative too. Right? Unfortunately, parents are so neurotic. They say, oh, don't do that. Oh, don't do this. Oh, don't do that. Oh, don't do this. Right? And then all of a sudden, we become very, very passive beings who are frightened to be creative. Right? And yet our soul needs to create because our soul is a spark of creator. Right? We need to create. God created a world that offers ultimate opportunities for creation. There's a lot of work here to be done. That's fantastic. Fantastic. So then, why do I stop on Shabbat? You see, if I don't stop on Shabbat, then I think my job is simply my job. Right? Imagine I'm working in a company, and the company closes on Saturday, and I still go in there to work. What am I basically saying? I don't identify with the company. Right? I do my own thing. I'm not really a part of a company. I don't really have a boss. I'm my own contractor. And that's simply not true. Right? Simply not true. The Jewish attitude is that the human being is an agent for God. That the human being is actually a malach, an angel. Right? How does the human being become an angel? By doing milacha. Angels are malachim. But I become an angel by doing milacha. Alright? And what am I really doing? I'm becoming an agent for God. In other words, the idea is that God created a work full of opportunities for creativity, and He appointed me, His agent, to do this creative work. And it's so great to work for the Creator. But when I'm all by myself, and my sole proprietor, and it's not a big job, you know? But when I feel like I'm part of this huge corporation, and we're all working for the boss, right? And we really love our boss, and we know that our boss has created this whole factory, and here we are, and he's entrusted us. He's entrusted with a tremendous amount of creative license. Unbelievable. But He's only asked us one thing. One thing. On Shabbat, please don't come into work. Right? Because on Shabbat you come into work, what you're basically saying is you don't work for me. Right? And if you don't work for me, you're cutting yourself off from the very source of creativity. Why would you want to do that? Why would you want to do that? And that's what happens when I don't work on Shabbat. When I don't work on Shabbat, I remind myself, hey, who am I working for anyways here? Am I working for IBM or am I working for God? Because I'd rather work for God. Because when I'm invested with the power of attorney, the power of agency by God, wow, I'm representing God in the world. Right? And I'm functioning on His behalf in this world. And that is a tremendous honor. That is something that's enlightening. That's something exciting. I work on behalf, I'm here doing this creative job on behalf of God who has entrusted me to do this. He could have done it himself. He didn't want to. He wanted to let me do it. So I can feel part of creativity. Right? But all of a sudden I get so confused and I forget, hey, who am I working for? And I begin to fall into this very egotistical, egocentric notion that I work for myself. And this creativity is my creativity. And it doesn't fit into a larger picture and it doesn't really serve in a greater theme. It's just my thing. So therefore, Shabbat is referred to as Mikor HaBrachot. Shabbat is the source of all blessings. If I stop working on Shabbat, what I'm testifying is I work for God. And everything I do is holy work. And everything I do is in the name of God. Right? And if I do in the name of God, it's on behalf of God, with the power of attorney of God, as a representative for God, as an associate creator with God. Wow. That's a whole different day. Whole different day. But the sad thing is, not a lot of Jews know this. It's really sad. Not a lot of Jews know this. They know that Shabbat is a day of rest, and they have found other ways of resting, right? Which seem to be more productive and more revitalizing because, you know, I go cycling, I go surfing. That's great for Sunday, right? But for Shabbat, I'm not just simply resting, right? I'm rejuvenating, right? I'm rejuvenating because I'm getting in touch with, wait, who am I? And that's real rest, and we talked about that last program also. That when you're not really fulfilling who you are, there's nothing more exhausting than that. I tell you, when you're in a job and you feel it's just not you, man, gosh, it could be the simplest job in the world. People are laughing at you. You're making a tremendous amount of money, very little responsibility on your head. It's really easy, breezy, wow. And you just come home, you're just wiped. You know, they got to scrape you off, you know. It's just, why? Because I'm not really answering to my inner needs. I'm not really being who I could be. Judaism says, I am a creator. Right? I am a spark of the creator. And not only do I create for myself, but I've got an even better job. I create for God. I can create for God on God's behalf. I can draw from the energy of God. Right? Wow. But if I don't stop in Shabbat and I go into the factory on Saturday, I'm living an illusion that somehow I own this factory or I work for myself. And it's very sad and it's very, very lonely to work for yourself. But it's much more beautiful to work for somebody else. But not just as a slave, but as an associate, especially when it's talking about creativity, especially when your boss gives you a tremendous amount of creative license. But he gives you tremendous creative license under one condition, that you don't forget where you're getting the creative energy. Because if you forget where you're getting the creative energy from, then you're going to lose the creative energy. And that's why it says, more than a Jew kept a Shabbat, the Shabbat kept the Jew, you know. And I don't know where I'd be today without celebrating Shabbat every week, because it just brings back a self-respect to you. It brings you back to yourself. It helps you question. It helps you ask. It reminds you, hey, you know, I'm not alone. And it's hard to be alone all week long because you start to feel you work for yourself, right? And nobody has a vested interest in you. But Judaism says that God has a vested interest in you. He invested a spark of his very self in you. And that's a mind-boggling concept. Right? And my life matters. What I do matters. Because what I'm doing is on behalf of God, and God has asked me, listen, I've created a world full of work to do. Oh, there's so much to do here. And you say, oh, thank you. What a wonderful world. What a wonderful world. Some say, I heard one shot, that's why Eve gave Adam the apple. She said, oh my gosh, do we really want to stay in this Garden of Eden? You know, I mean, come on. It's like this rich son whose father was multi-millionaire. Everything's in place. Kid has nothing to do. Right? So she really felt, listen, maybe it's a necessary evil, but we got to get out of such paradise into a world where there's struggle. But then again, in a world where there's possibility for creativity. Right? Creativity and possibility to really do something. So I heard one commentary like that about the Garden of Eden. We once learned, we have the song, L'cha dodi likrat Shabbat, p'nei Shabbat nekabalah. Come, my beloved, towards the bride, the face of Shabbat we will receive. Rav Nachman of Breslov says, what does it mean the face of Shabbat I will receive? But that on Shabbos you get a whole new face. You know, maybe the week my face was an attaché case. Maybe the week my face was an... And maybe the week my face was a computer monitor, maybe it was a whistle, I don't know. But on Shabbos, I get a whole new Shabbos face. A face that reflects the eternal, the infinite. A face that reflects the I am that I am. The free being, the creative one, who can transcend nature and thereby bond with the supernature, the soul of souls, the source of source. The divine.
This presentation by Rabbi David Aaron has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-3000. 4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.